This is tape 2A, and we are taping Dora Freely.
Freilich.
Oh. And this is Helen Grossman interviewing. Go ahead.
And so we knew that there are some young people that are running away to the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So my father said, so suppose I go and I survive, what good is it for me? I have a family, I have 4 children. What is my life without them and without my wife? I don't need it. If we go, we go all together. Second, we're going to survive. We had a lot of hope.
Did you have relatives around you at that time?
We all lived in one house. My uncle, I have one cousin that is now in New York. They had a very big rooming house. I think it was the biggest rooming house in the city, for that matter. Because the Hebrew University and the Hebrew school was in the adjoining building, which belonged also to my uncle. They used to say that he was the richest man in town. And he had a certain name that they called him, a special forget. Because as it is here, you wanted to be like everybody else. You didn't want to be the richest. You wanted to have better things, maybe. But there was a certain thing that my mother always used to tell me. Always say that you are older, because we were big children. I guess it comes from better eating, from better living conditions. I was a big girl, because I'm a big woman for a European woman, you know. Now they are bigger, but years ago they were smaller. My mother used to say, when they ask you, say that you are 7. I said, Mommy, I'm only 5. She said, say that you're 7. We had bicycles, which not everybody had. Maybe, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 families. There's a bicycle for a girl, there's a bicycle for a boy. We had 2 bicycles. My father used to say, ah, don't go. You know, that was the evil eye. It always was
right.
The evil eye.
Yeah.
Because we were big children, we were well taken care of, and very well dressed. So, where does he come to live a family like this? We go together, we stay together. It's one or the other. This was the, I guess, the Jewish concept, but it was the family concept, and that's why I have seen and read it in many books, that if the families were not so close-knit together, which helped in one way and hurt in the other way, our great hope and our great bond with the families made us so much, gave us so much more hope. That's why we were killed in such masses, because we went together, always hoping that it couldn't be that bad. The war between the Russians and the Germans was going strong, otherwise Poland was nothing to occupy. They just went through and left just the people to take care, and they were going deep into Russia. Now, the worst the war was going for them, the worst we got it in the ghetto, or by that talking, you know, it one reflected on the other. In 1942, by the end of 1942, there was a group of boys that had run away to the forest. That time I didn't know them. And they came into the Judenrat to help them raise money for ammunition. Because otherwise, you're not accepted. You must present a piece, a revolver, anything. Because even in the forest, there is always, you know, you are not accepted unless you have some ammunition with you. The rumor goes, although it's not a rumor anymore, because we had just had a book published And I have read some stories that I did not know about my town, which was very interesting to me to read about it. The rumor has it that those boys were caught by two German officials that came in at the same time to the Judenrat to ask for some extra silver or some extra boots or some extra, you know, linen, etc., etc. And they saw them there. And they thought that the Judenrat and the boys are connected, which maybe in some way they were, but not to an extent to do something wrong to the ghetto. Otherwise, the Judenrat took care of the ghetto as much as they could, providing them with jobs, providing them with food, providing them with lodging, trying to accommodate for all those people that were brought into the ghetto. And this was the moment that they were wearing uniforms, Russian uniforms, half Russians, half Germans, whatever they could find in the forest. And this is, they say, when it started. They accused the Judenrat of being in contact and supporting the Jews in the forests. And so they surrounded the ghetto with German soldiers. Now, we had a guy that worked in our bakery for as long as I can remember. At that time, I'm going already, I'm 16. We still had a little baby. And the ghetto was fenced in, but not on all sides. There were some creeks running through. And this guy that worked for my father for so many years came, you know, and through somebody, he said, let me have the baby. Let me take the baby to my village. She's blonde. We were all dark hair. That baby was blonde. I don't know what's going to happen. The rumors are bad, but we are hearing. You know, they were afraid too. They were not killing them. Let me have the baby.
This was a Christian man.
Yeah. And
how'd your family feel?
We debated about it. And we decided to give him the baby. After 2 days, the guards from the fences, the Germans, were taken away. And we thought the Judenrat took care of everything and it's going to go on. Again, we'll work, we'll struggle, we'll die, we won't have any food, we don't have any heat, but we still have each other. So we started looking at each other, and my father said, we're going to bring the baby back.
This was the second day.
That was more than the second day. She was already there a week. We said, why should we tear apart a family? It's quieting down, let's be together again. And we gave him notice and that we want the baby back.
How did you get the message to him?
Through the fence, there were a little trading, you know, on the side with the peasants.
You send the message.
Right. And he begged us not to take the baby back, to leave the baby with him. But his family, he himself had a family, I think, of 7 children. He said, one more, let it be there. And that, when I told this to my children when they were growing up, I don't know if I should mix those two things together, but it's interesting. Always when we used to go for a ride in the car, we used to sing a song about a mother that gives a child away. It's a Yiddish song. It's a very... So every time we used to go into the car, my son used to say, Mommy, let's sing that song. Because the mother gives the baby away to the Christian family And although the baby, they look out through the window, there are two blonde girls and that little baby boy, a little boy with black hair and black eyes. And the baby's crying that the words in the songs, I want to go with you, I don't want to stay here. But she's begging God, just take care of the baby, because I cannot take care of him anymore. And that's why I want him to live. So every time we got in the car, my son used to say to me, Mommy, let's sing that song.
So what happened with your...
So he brought the baby back. Baby at that time was a year and a half, I would say. Close to a year.
It must have been very hard for your mother to give up the baby.
Well, we were there in the ghetto already for a long time, and we saw what was going on, and the situation was deteriorating. And with this situation of catching the boys in the Judenrat, we knew, we started to, like everybody, woke up to something. What can we do? There was nothing that could be done. You could not fight the Germans. You also did not have the Polish gentile population with you. They were just like the Germans and worse. So the story is that we didn't fight back. How can you? If you're surrounded on all four sides by enemies shooting from all sides at you, what can you do? So one morning, the Judenrat announced, and that takes very close time, it's about 2 weeks since they found the boys in the Judenrat, and they evacuation of our town. Now, we lived in a small town, so we don't have the big train. We had a small train, they called it. They took you to the train that went from big city to big city.
Was the whole ghetto emptied?
The whole ghetto was emptied. They took us on sleds. It was in January. It's cold, bitter cold.
1942.
The end of 1942, beginning of 1943. The peasants were ordered to come with the sleds. They told us to pack whatever we can take with us, the necessities. And on the sleds, with the sleds, we were taken to the train. Now, in a little town, and when you are in business, you know a lot of people that you deal with. They said, you know, the rumors, even the gentle people, some like said to my father, the rumors are coming true, unbearable. They say they are killing the Jews all over where they are taking them. We don't know, we don't have papers, they took away radios, we didn't have nothing. And my father said, he don't want to listen to it, he's going with the family together, and this is it. And we went.
How long a ride on the sleds?
On the sleds, the ride was not too long. On the sled, it was like, I would say for about the standing and waiting until every sled was filled. You know, there's sick people and crew and lame people and children and babies.
Emptied out the whole ghetto.
Emptied out the whole ghetto. And then they took us on the trains. It's like a 7 mile ride by sled. It's 2 hours, it's 3 hours. And then they packed us into the trains, in the cattle cars.
Well, your family was still together in the cattle cars.
Together. And they were going with a speed. On every cattle car, there was two Germans on both sides. At that time, everybody started looking for ways of going, surviving, and everybody started howling at my father, do something, do something. So he looked at us, he saw four small children. But still, he jumped out of the train and he got killed. He jumped and he said before he jumped, he said to us, if we ever stay alive, we'll meet back in our town. And he jumped. I think 15, my sister was 17, my brother was 13, and the baby was 2
when he did this.
Yeah.
And your mother?
And your mother was, my mother was with us.
Was he trying to get away? Was that it?
It was a lot of pressure. We were going through little towns. It was not even like this. It was in the ghetto already. Our town was evacuated in 3 days. There was not enough sleds to take everybody. So they took, through the time being in the ghetto, a lot of people built bunkers where they were hiding. Now I think we had built the biggest bunker in town. Of course, nobody survived in that bunker, because if a dog would come and sniff, you would,
that was it.
So by the time they started to take us away, my uncle said to my father, you are so young, you are not even 40. Do something. So this is the tragic thing in our family. My mother and my brother and the little baby went on the third transport. And my father took me and my sister and 3 of my cousins and my uncle, and we hid in the bunker for 2 nights, thinking that we are going to survive. When we saw that we cannot do it, that we have not enough food, we don't have light, so we returned back to our house. We packed up everything that we had to take along for the baby, cookies, sugar, things that were very precious to us. And
Any kind of food.
Food was very important. That was the main thing of survival. And we went with the 4th transport. That was the 4th day. We went. So actually my father had only me and my older sister. He gave us some money and he said, do your best. You'll meet your mother and the children there, because we are all going to a working camp. So we're going to need the mother and the 2 children.
Did you know which camp you were going to?
No. As we were passing by, I think it was not far near Warsaw, which is very far from our part of town.
F-A-N-Y-A?
Warsaw.
Oh, Warsaw.
Warsaw.
That
was the capital of...
Mm-hmm.
There was outside, they could see through the little windows, people working outside, fixing probably the laying new
track.
And
the
they
track
knew
and the
how many people went through here and nobody comes back. And they were showing that we are all going to be killed.
With your, and as you draw your, you just drew your hand across your neck.
Yeah.
And that was the motion.
Those people.
The repair people showed you.
Showed
where you were going.
Where we were going, because the train was full. So my father decided, I don't know if it's like, probably like something runs through your mind like suicide. You plan on it, but you never think that you're going to do it if you are suicidal. And he jumped out. I have returned home in 1945. I went back to Russia.
Let's go back. let's finish with that. After your father jumped, then you went, the train was moving to...
Moving. It was constantly moving. There were two more people that jumped from the same
train,
cattle car, from ours. There were others that jumped from others, too.
When they were jumped, I guess they were shot right away.
There were shots, but we didn't think that he was shot. But in the long run, we have never found him. And nobody had seen him in concentration camp. I have looked for him all over. I have returned back home for that reason. So he was shot probably on the spot. There is one guy that jumped from the same cattle car that is alive. But as the train goes, you jump from both sides. He obviously jumped on the side that was closer to the forest. That all has a bearing, every little thing. And he could run right away into the forest or whatever, he's alive.
How long did that train trip last? Have you any idea?
That train trip lasted, I think it was 2 or 3 days. Three nights and 3 days.
Any food?
Nothing. The people were just dying in the train. There was standing room only. You made where you stood. There was nothing to drink, nothing to eat. The cries.
The suffering.
It's unbelievable. And there's nothing you can do. You go. So whoever dies, dies, and you lay right, you stand next to him. It was me and my sister and 100 other people, neighbors, friends. You know, people that you live a lifetime together with, that you spend your youth, teachers that you've been afraid of at one time, now are together with you in the car. And then we came to Auschwitz. And that ride on the train, I had put it in a special category. It took me months until I found not the proper words, but until I found myself to get myself together and just imagine and put it on the paper, that ride on the train.
And you've written that?
Yeah. And then we came to Auschwitz. I didn't know what Auschwitz is. Lights, opening of the doors of the cattle cars, and everything, dead or alive, everything is falling out. From 100, I don't know if there were 40 survivors in our car. And every car the same thing, and there's maybe 40 chemicals together. We see from far away, we see smoke.
This was 1942.
That was 1943 already.
A 43.
January 1943. We are already in Auschwitz. Otherwise, 42. The end of 41 is the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of 42 is when we are starting to see that something is going to happen. They surround the ghetto, they go away again. And this is when a lot of young people run away.
They
young
the
men.
Forest?
Yes. And that's where we met that famous Dr. Mengele.
At Auschwitz.
At Auschwitz. He was, I don't know if he was at every upcoming train, but he was at ours. At that time we didn't know who he was. It was left or right, left or right.
Were they separating you then?
they were separating. You had to pass by, like they were standing four military men. And subconsciously, you somehow realize that they are looking for something. They are not looking for the lame people, not looking for the sick people. They are looking for the stronger ones that are still walking. So right away, your mind starts working. And I don't know what I never figured it out. But at the moment when you see death before your eyes, your desire to live is so great that you try to do right away something about it. You straighten up and you already start. It's like an animal instinct. I don't know what it is, but this is what it is. And me and my sister fall into a lane that goes into the concentration camp.
She felt it too, and she straightened up too.
Yeah. At that time, it was probably that they emptied out Auschwitz. They used to empty it every couple of months. Because Auschwitz was already, that was in 43. There were people there from 4 years before, 3 years at least before. So every time, beside the dead ones that died inside and at work, they used to come and empty the whole, that they needed new arrivals.
They needed the space.
They needed the space they had. They needed new people, new strength
to work,
new work. And that was the time when we were coming in.
You said Dr. Mengele was right there.
Dr. Mengele was right there.
You didn't know who he was, though.
No.
All right.
As a rule, from our city, from Prozhane, there was a big amount of people that survived. We always come together for the last 40 years and always talk about it. We have our Yiske meeting, which we conduct in New York. And of course, there is very few left. It gets less and less. People die of old age. But it's again, they took care of each other as much as they could.
It's an extended family.
It was like something like carried on, like
caring
for each other. And this is where I come in again with that book, which things that I did not even know that existed, that some people could get to some medication. The medication was only, what we used to get a lot is diarrhea. We were separated, men and women were not together.
In the bunks?
In the bunk. There was two separate concentration camps all together. It was for men and there was for women. One thing, a German soldier would not touch us, so there were very few rapes. This is very important.
I thought it was the other way around.
No.
Why were they were not allowed?
Because they were not allowed. Also, Jewish people were worse than dogs. I mean, this was the lowest. So you didn't have to touch the lowest. There were a lot of Gentile people in the concentration camp that came in for different reasons, not because
they were
political. They were also for reasons that they were, burglars or thief, some criminal, hard criminals.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that were taking care of us. This is the situation. So we come into the concentration camp, and Poland has a very severe winter. I mean, we get winter in September, and we lay put till April with it. Auschwitz is a town in Silesia. It has a very long winter. Auschwitz is the concentration camp.
And how do you spell the town?
Well, how they spelled it in Polish was Oświęcim.
How would that translate?
Auschwitz.
No, Slavia, the town.
Oświęcim. That was in Polish, but it's known by Auschwitz. Auschwitz is the main concentration camp. We are in Birkenau.
What is Birkenau?
Birkenau is where...
Spell Birkenau.
B-I-R-K-E-N-A-U.
And is that the town?
No, that's not the town. That's what they call this concentration camp, Birkenau.
That's part of...
Part of Auschwitz, that belongs to Auschwitz.
This is tape 2B, and this is Dora Freilich being interviewed by Helen Grossman. Go on.
Now we are in Birkenau, which is part of Auschwitz. And we are taking the girls separate, the men separate, or rather so the women separate and men separate. And we are marched into the concentration camp.
Let me go back to one place. When you said that the people were divided, those who went to the concentration camp and the rest went where?
Straight to the crematoriums.
Now let's go back to the concentration camp.
All the old, all the young, all the children, everything that...
Children, too.
Babies, children. There were such incidents where... When I say that the will to live is so strong that mothers have thrown away their children, given to their mothers, young mothers. When they realized in that moment that this must be the game that's going to be here. And we are marched into the concentration camp. It's all fenced in. Electrical wire fencing, and there is an entrance. And above the entrance, there is a saying, Arbeit macht frei, otherwise work makes you free. Although I'm already 16 years old, still, you cannot believe that there would be a people or a nation or that would want to kill another for what? There's got to be reasons. But there was no reason. There was only because we were born Jewish. We are taking into a barrack, which is called a sauna. It's like a, to give us disinfection and to have
were the Jews and the Christians mixed up at that point?
This is strictly Jews only. This is
at this point.
This at this point, from the ghetto, on the train, this is strictly Jews. Whatever we found, whatever we met of Gentiles, were in the concentration camp, brought in at different times for different reasons, for stealing, for robbing, political, all kinds.
And your barrack was all Jewish?
The barracks were mostly Jewish. The ones that were taking care of us, the overseers, were the hardened criminals that were Germans. Now they had the power over us. The ones that had already been years and years in concentration camps, sent away for different reasons, they were now over us. Now we come into that place, and we go through, first they shave our heads, then they shave our armpits and our private places with dull razors, and then comes the tattoo of the numbers, and we look at to each other, what's going on? But it's like masses coming one after the other, and we hear a voice, which I also put in writing, it's better than taking the Heavenly Express. You still have a little time on your hands. One thing, try to keep yourself as healthy as you can under those conditions, and maybe you will survive. And Auschwitz is not picnic at all. Now this is the worst. I don't even have words. I don't even know a nation, a people that ever had done anything so brutal as it was done in Birkenau. The burning, the killing
of the people.
Here we are all young female. It's strictly female. This is, I'm talking about my concentration camp where I am.
You're talking about burning there in front of you?
In front of us. The crematoriums are in distance that we can see. This never stops for 1 minute. The clouds of smoke go up constantly, and then when that cannot do it well enough, then they take out the corpses and they stack them up and they put them on fire. And this is all done
in
front of us.
You were forced to watch this?
No, we were not forced to watch this specific thing, but you cannot avoid it. You see it because it's going on day and night until Eichmann shows up in camp.
Did you see him when he did?
I have seen him. I did not see him personally. We knew there were always little rumors coming around into the camp and something said that some very big official came. He came then with that big proposition that the Jewish people are not getting killed too fast. It's too slow a process.
Not fast enough.
Not fast enough. The process is too slow. And he looked in. This, we were told then about it after the war by people that worked at the crematoriums. You know, the people had to work at it too. They kept them only for a certain time. Mostly men worked at it, no women.
Jewish?
Jewish men. Jewish and Gentile, I guess, mostly Jewish. Mm-hmm. That they had to shove them into the shower, supposedly. And then they kept them for a certain time, those people, the Jewish people that worked on them, and then they killed them. Otherwise, if anything happened, they should never, they thought they could catch it in time, that nothing will come out, how this was functioning. Well, at that time, there were rumors that Eichmann came into camp and that he was a very high official, and he has a certain method that it's going to speed up the killing of the Jews. And he brought in that X, whatever it was called, a cyclone.
That was it. That was it.
That killed the people in less than, I think.
It began with a Z, I think.
Cyclone.
Mm-hmm.
Cyclone. In less than 4 minutes. Otherwise, the majority was killed. The majority was gassed. Was the gas.
The cyclone was a gas.
The cyclone.
Yeah.
The
right,
gas. That
right.
This was a better method. It was a stronger gas, and it was doing a better job. Well, a lot of people were still alive because they gave you just a certain amount of time, like 25 minutes. Then you dropped dead. If you're dead, you're dead. If you're not dead, you're going to burn anyway. The people were still there. You had to burn them. Where do you dispose of so many bodies? This is millions and millions of bodies. Well, life in Birkenau, I don't have words to describe it.
What
I don't know why I survived.
What
I don't
was
know
it
how.
Like in the morning?
We got up at about 4 a.m. They woke us up. And we stood in front of our barracks, 5 in a row.
How many people would you say, 20, 30, 40?
In the barrack, there were a couple of hundreds of people at the barrack.
Five in a row.
We stood until there was a little bit of light coming through. They counted us constantly. One thing the Germans have, dead or alive, the number must be there.
If somebody died during the night?
Not some, but there are many. You brought them all out, and you piled them up in front of the barrack.
Everybody would carry out the dead.
Everybody would carry out the dead, put them in front of the barrack, and that's how they were counted. Dead or alive. If from work, we used to carry them with us. And at one of those, this was after being already about 7 months, in Birkenau, and the girls were dying left and right. Sickness, no food, lice. The lice ate us up alive.
There was no chance for any kind of washing or bathroom facilities, I'm sure.
That was
the hole.
This was the hole.
Yeah.
And they give you only this much time
in the bathroom.
In the bathroom. For everybody together. Finished, unfinished, you go. The ground in Birkenau is lime, and you sink into it. You just sink into it. And in the winter time, with the wooden shoes, if you get stuck in it and you cannot get out, you die right there.
It's like cement.
It's like a diluted cement. I don't know what you call it here. This is the kind of ground there is.
It was probably lime.
It was lime.
Yeah.
And the snow and the rains and everything together dilutes,
so
and
it
gets mud. And if you go with your wooden shoes and you get stuck.
And you can't pull it out.
You can't pull it out. Everyone went down to the weight of, I don't know, 40 pounds, 45 pounds. Every day there was less and less girls. One day we worked, every day we walked to work. Our work consisted of doing a lot of nothing but heavy work. We built highways. We carried heavy stones, gravel, everything that had to do with building construction. No matter how many we walked out in the morning, we had to bring everyone back with us into the camp.
Was there any food in the morning?
In the morning was just black coffee.
And then at, I'm sure midday there wasn't anything.
Midday, they used to bring soup. And this is where the accident with my, wasn't an accident. My sister was with me. I came in with my sister. And we walked out this morning to a commander to work. And approximately the rumors get around. There's sometimes somebody that's a little better, a little bit more hard, even in a German. So she would leave the girls alone, you know, let them work, but at least not beat them while they were working. Because the working and the beating was unbearable. And somehow we could not get into that unit. The running, the commotion in the morning was so great because everybody wanted to run into the unit that they thought was better. So right there, right there you got killed, you got shot. The Lagerstrasse, which means the street, where you walk out, you had to parade. When your unit walked.
Every morning.
Every morning. When you walked, the orchestra played. There were the best players in white suits playing songs. And we walked out.
Men and women in
the
orchestra?
Men and women, yeah.
How big an orchestra?
I would say about 30 people. 40 people.
Were they Jewish at all?
Yeah.
They were chosen probably because they were from symphonies themselves.
Right. Like the playing for time, the story. She was playing in that orchestra.
Yeah.
And then when we marched to work, we had to sing. We had to sing German songs. For not singing, for not keeping up, you could be shot on the spot. So here we march on a highway. People are going back and forth and seeing a crowd of very happy girls going to work, singing loud and clear.
And you, civilians would see you marching.
Passing by.
And they would know that you were from the camp.
They would know that we come from somewhere. They knew, they saw the smoke that was going for miles and miles. And yet after the war, everybody said they didn't know anything.
I've heard it constantly.
Now this one time, we could not get into a unit that was halfway decent, what you called, at least you worked, but you didn't get beat up. And we fell into that unit where we walked out with four Germans, six German shepherds. This is how a unit worked out. 200 girls. And we came to a place where we had to carry mud. We put our coats, whatever we had of, with our buttons in the front, in the back. The buttons used to be in the back, and we carried.
Why did you do that?
That's what they told us to do. On top, we were like in a valley. On top, there were standing girls who were Gentile girls, also from the concentration camp. And they were, we used to pass by them and they used to put in the dirt, the heavy, wet dirt into our coats, or if there were not enough coats, then they gave us like wheelbarrows, like to...
Mm-hmm.
And that day, I think, was the worst day. We brought from that day about 20 dead girls. From this work day.
What was the purpose of buttoning the coat in the back?
That we could have the front of the coat
to use the coat
to carry with.
I see.
Also, this was our Sundays were also done for the same purpose. Sunday we did not go out to work, but we did the same thing in the concentration camp.
Why didn't they
That was play to them. That their enjoyment was our agony. The more agony, the more they enjoyed it. So they used to think of things to do.
To harass.
If they stood there and they were young soldiers, and they, for instance, said to one another, let's see, can you get her? Can you shot her? Shoot her from here? He said, I'll try. So he did. He said, you didn't do it, I'll do it. So he got her. Another one put on the ground, dead. And this is where my sister got killed.
Because somebody was playing games.
Playing games. Just playing games.
She was shot for no reason.
For no reason. They were bringing down, the truck went by, and they left like the soup, which was given to us at noontime. The soup was brought in, it was like barrels, but they were made out of steel. And they closed up real, I guess they used them for soldiers here too, like, I've seen it, but I...
With the top clamps on.
Right, with the top clamps on the sides, right. And they, since we were like in a valley, they left it on top, and the girls had to go up and bring it down, and they were heavy. So this was a picnic for the soldiers, because that's when they could see real agony at play. They send up like six girls, and one of those things with the soup opened up while they were sliding down with it, and they all got burned. Not all burned right away, parts. And then they shot them. We had brought that day 20 or 24 dead girls to the camp.
And you had to bring your sister back.
I had to bring my sister. We carried them. We always worked out. They were made out of wood, like, I don't know what you call it here, to carry things.
A barrel?
Yeah, but you put it on the shoulders. Mm-hmm. You always worked out with this because you knew that you're going to bring some girls back dead. There was no other way. This was the way of life. But to bring 22 or 24 back, dead and carry them. It was almost every row. We marched in fives. Every row carried a dead girl. The applause that they got entering was unbelievable of a job good done.
That the soldiers got,
right? This was for them something.
These girls weren't buried when they were brought back.
These girls had to be brought in.
Yeah, then what?
Brought to our barracks, mm-hmm. where we belonged, put down on the floor, counted together with us, then they were burned. Then they were put on trucks and taken to the crematorium. They were dead already anyway. But you had to bring them back because everything had to be accounted for.
Very systematic, the Germans. Very systematic.
This is how it worked.
Tell me what the situation was. Did you become friends with the other people? A lot of them you knew? Some of them you knew.
Well, most of the time.
I'm talking about the other girls in your barracks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you know, we all like walked in. It was all from our town. You know, girls that we knew, girls that we went to school together, girls that came into our ghetto from the neighboring towns that mm-hmm. we got acquainted during the ghetto times. And again, it was like a helping hand everybody tried to encourage everybody else. The older ones tried to do it to the younger. By older, I mean the 25, 27-year-old look to us like we are, you know, children, and they are the older. So they try to encourage us to try to keep clean, to try to be good to each other, try not to steal the food from each other. And we always paired off like two together. If we got a portion of bread, we ate one in the morning and we kept one. Otherwise, we put together both our portions. We ate one together and we kept one.
To save it.
For save it. I was with a girl that was not from my town, and she was from Grodno.
Poland.
Mm-hmm. And I had, she was in our ghetto.
Grodno is G-R-O-D-N-O.
Grodno. G-R-O-D-N-O.
Mm-hmm.
And her name was Dora too. And we like for a little time shared our, we slept on the same bunk together, and we shared the food together. And she used to tell me, she says, you'll see, we'll live, and I have an uncle in America, was no United States, even in the United States, and he's a big actor, and we'll come to him, he's my uncle, and you'll see, we'll have it so good. Her uncle was...
he really was an actor?
He was her uncle. He
yeah.
was, what was his name? He played in Papierosen.
On the Jewish day?
Yeah, on the Jewish day. Yeah, I don't think he's alive anymore, but he played in the play Papierosen,
right.
In Cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
with his wife, and that was her uncle, that was her father's brother, and obviously they stayed in contact very close because she knew that he plays the Jewish theater. She even knew Brooklyn, we called it Brooklyn. O was the O in
mm-hmm.
Polish,
mm-hmm.
and two O's made it bigger for us in Brooklyn. Can I offer you something, maybe
no.
like a drink, a
no.
coffee, a soda,
no,
anything?
No, I just want you to go ahead with your story.
And she said, you'll see. He'll be so good to us because he always sends us money. This is where we come back, that the families did help. He sent us for every Yontef. He sends us money. And we have something to live on, and we'll be with him. He lives in Brooklyn.
That sounded like heaven.
That sounded like heaven. That gave you a little bit of hope, which was very little left, very little. At that time, on the bunk, there were like three tires. We slept in the middle. It was me, my sister.
Did she sleep
four
with
cousins,
the same
yeah. Four cousins and four friends. We slept like this. Everybody wanted to be together. It was me, the only one left. They all died at work or of sickness or shot for play or taken for experiments, which is another very bad.
Let me stop you here. Tell me what you knew about the experiments.
Okay.
You mentioned Mengele before.
Mengele was the doctor, who they say is still alive. Mengele had his own way of doing things. First of all, he rode on a motorcycle on the Lagerstrasse. Now, the Lagerstrasse was the street.
The main street.
The main street of the camp. On both sides were the barracks. And this is where we used to, if we were ready to go, if my unit was ready to go, we marched out on the Lagerstrasse, we had to walk straight up to the entrance, we counted again, but our Lagerfeld and the one that took care on our bank, everything had to be, the account, the number had to be there.
Spell Lagerstrasse. Is that L-A?
Lager would be L-A-G-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And Strasse means street, would
mm-hmm.
be S-T-R-A-S-S-E.
Lagerstrasse. Go ahead.
So in the middle, as a unit of 200 girls, of 150 girls used to walk, he used to suddenly run in with his motorcycle. So whoever got killed, got killed. No business of his. That was his pleasure. On both sides of the Lagerstrasse were two, what was it? You don't call it streams of water. It were just two
Creeks.
Canals.
Creeks.
No, just
canals.
Yeah. That's what the girls fell in. Later on,
with water
into the mud.
Right.
When he was through with his enjoyment, put together back the unit of people, of the girls. If 20 were dead, then there were 20 available right away. I mean, put them back, went out to work. That was Mengele's enjoyment. His enjoyment was also his plans of taking beautiful young girls, cutting them up in pieces, and making all kinds of experiments with them. This was by the end of 1944. At that time, I'm already 2 years in Birkenau, that's Auschwitz. There is very few of us left. There is few, I mean the ones that I know.
Did you know of any of the people who were taken? Did you know the people personally that were taken from Mengele's experiments?
And I knew one girl, and she was alive after the war. I had met her after the war.
And she survived.
She survived. You see, the experiments were many of different kinds. They were at their will to do whatever they want. So if they performed operation, they didn't have to sew you up. They wanted to see how it works without, inside, without doing.
Without
closing it. If they made like what they call here now, baby in
hysterectomy?
Not
no,
hysterectomy.
The where the baby is taken from the womb.
The baby
from
is
the womb.
Is taken from the womb or the inseminate, what do you call it? The where they take the sperm and you
the artificial insemination.
Artificial, right.
They did that.
They did that. But they had to watch it how it grows. What it does. And to them, to cut up a Jewish girl and see how this is doing inside on a person,
probably without painkillers.
The girl